282 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. The Sun and the Moon. By such occult means do irrational natures manifest the abundance of superessential virtuim, parted to them out of the fullness of divine natures. 4. Further details consult the notes at the end of the 1821 edition of Thomas Taylor's translation of Lamblish's On the Mysteries of the Egyptians, Chaldeans, and Assyrians. As previously suggested, the virtue of the gods springs from their abundant unity. It is a Platonic axiom that the principal, chief, subsistence of everything is according to the summit of its essence. In other words, all bodies and constitutions are to be measured by the dignity of their first principles or natures, for this principle is the true measure of the capacity and limitation of the thing suspended from it, because no thing can become greater than its source. To mingle with superiors, it must cease, therefore, in its own nature. Emerging from the indivisible unity or wholeness, the gods thus partake of the virtue of this their summit. They, accordingly, differ from man in that while man has for his apex the rational mind, the gods flow downward toward rationality from a far more exalt sphere. Philosophy is a discipline which impels all activities to flow toward their own causal principle. Its chief province, therefore, is to restore all natures to their origins and thus accomplish the perfection of natures, for that is perfect which has been accepted back into the fullness of its own unity. Among the most mysterious symbols employed by the Egyptians were two pyramids united at their apexes, open verted, and the other upright, to signify the interchange of divine and natural powers. While this particular symbol has already been briefly discussed, it will not be out of order to amplify the previous description. The inverted pyramid, with its foundation in the superior sphere, they termed inspiration, the upright, with its foundation upon the inferior sphere, they termed aspiration. Hence both of these forces commingle in natures. From the inferior the urge of the rational disciplines is toward the elevation of natures, from the superior, which is an attracting agency, the urge of inspiration is ascent toward divine perfections. If the symbol be closely examined, we become aware of a more archaic meaning, for recognizing the pyramids as flowing from their own apexes, we discover that the central point from which both diverge is the abiding place of the superiors. From this superior point, one pyramid, usually shown as dark, flows upward, its color signifying the occult nature of its properties, which must forever remain dark and mysterious to the intellect ions of unillumined mortals. The second pyramid flows downward, becoming the tangible universe, which is luminous to the many and susceptible of a certain degree of analysis by even those who are unenlightened. These two pyramids represent, therefore, the duad existing within and flowing from the monad, polarity manifesting out of simple unity, through which manifestation the universe came into being. Between the unseen sphere of principles above and the visible sphere of personalities below is a ceaseless interchange of activities. Separateness being the law of personalities, and unity the law of principles, it is evident that while each body occupies some place, each principle occupies every place. All principles are therefore capable of manifesting in each body. Upon this fact was based the philosophic deduction that place is of relatively small importance in matters pertaining to the higher sciences. Socrates was once accosted by a seeker after truth, who asked him where could be found the best place in which to learn. The great skeptic instantly replied, "Where thou art, for, whereas the learner was in place, learning was everywhere." The two consequently awaited the unifying effect of rationality, which when present links place with everywhere. Theology particularly has become a servant to the concept of place. Among nearly all religious peoples it is a common practice to sanctify places of worship and be in attendance at the performance of certain holy offices in such places. The tombs of the saints are also hallowed, and there is a widespread veneration for sacred objects of every description. A visit to Jerusalem will demonstrate the influence wielded by such veneration for place. Here every pebble is more venerable than a boulder elsewhere, and even the filth spreads piety instead of plague. Theology also limits the mind to the concept of time. Demigods and Supermen 283. 284 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. As a factor in religious place. Witness the holy days when prayer is presumed to have a special efficacy and the celestial hierarchies are said to be peculiarly receptive to the whining import unities of men. Assembly for the common purpose of worship may confer certain ethical and sociological virtues. For instance, by inspiring the courage born of numbers, but little importance can be attached to the practice if viewed from the standpoint of spirit. In the terms of pure metaphysical philosophy, the gods as causal agencies are both omnipresent and omniscient, free from time and place, above condition, and incapable of such purely mundane concepts as pleasure or displeasure. They flow unimpeded through the many dimensional vistas of eternity. If would-be reformers can correct the theological absurdity that the gods are localized like the weather, systematized like industry, or dispositioned like ward politicians, there is still hope for the religious instincts of the race. Plutarch of Chaeronea, one of the early Gnostic fathers, in his Vision of Aridaeus, describes an excursion made by a benighted soul into the realm of Hades, where with the aid of the single, or psychic, eye he perceived many things with greater clarity than is the fortune of most mortals. Aridaeus, the man who had the vision, is supposed to have died and found himself in a great sea of light, of objects with which he had been previously familiar. He saw none save the stars. They were, however, of stupendous size and at enormous distances from one another, and poured forth a marvelous radiance of color and sound, so that the soul riding smoothly in the light, as a ship in calm weather, sailed easily and swiftly in every direction. Omitting most of the things he saw, he said that the souls of the dead, in passing from below upwards, formed a flame-like bubble from which the air was excluded. Then the bubble quietly broke, and they came forth with men like forms and well-knit frames. Secretary the Vision of Aridaeus. Translated by G.R.S. Mead. Compiled during the first century of the Christian era, this curious allegory is of particular interest to the modern student. Demigods and Supermen 285. Of Platonic philosophy, for the bubble-like souls with flaming luminosity that flowed past Aridaeus represent the spheres of isolation within which the rational nature must remain during the period of irrationality, that is, before the one hears the call of the all and chooses to mingle its destiny with the common cause. This flame-like bubble constitutes the interval between man as the partly illumined creature and the gods as divine potentialities. Although man exists in these god essences, he cannot be united with these infinite certainties until he causes this bubble to quietly break. This is a direct allusion to the rites of the mysteries, and we suspect that Plutarch wrote not of the after-death state but of that secret ritualism whereby the dead soul in a living body is liberated to the contemplation of divinities. As institutions of illumination, the mysteries are agencies appointed to prick the bubble of self-conceit that envelops the average soul, and thereby renders it impervious to divine ministrations. The well-formed bodies seen by Aridaeus coming forth out of the broken bubbles represent the organized rationalities which arc manifested after the consciousness has been liberated from the inferior sphere, that iridescent world which, mirror like, shows man only the reflection of himself, leaving him unaware of the great within in the nature of which he floats. The sea of luminosity in which the soul floats like a ship presents the causal universe, whose divine agencies, manifesting first as colors and sounds, mingle in an exotic symphonic profusion. Aridaeus also declares that in this luminous world he felt as though he was breathing all over, for his whole body was filled with a life-giving air that gave the sense of buoyancy and freedom from every oppression of matter. Air is the inscient and secret symbol of rationality, and represents the intangible illumined mind that is declared to be absent from the contents of the bubbles, the symbols of irrationality. The free air of the spirit comes to relieve man when he is willing to renounce the oppressed atmosphere of the body. This is the secret of the enthusiasm of the ancient mysteries, the ecstasy that came upon those who breathed in the gods for 286 lectures on Ancient philosophy. By divine enthusiasm was signified unity with God, as the word itself implies, entheos, in God. Those who were in the nature and consciousness of cause thus ceased to move of their own accord, but their frantic gyrations were regarded as evidence that a divine spirit was agitating and mingling them with universals. When Socrates declared that where thou art is the place to learn, he thereby revealed the universality of cause. The fact that all men do not actively partake of the all-permeating learning implies a barrier between learning and the learner, between life and the living, between the good and those who strive for virtue. This barrier is the quality interval referred to in the preceding chapter, to be overcome only by the discus plines of the mysteries, for alone and unaided, men cannot sufficiently organize their internal natures to achieve this most necessary end. The gods are presumed to be superior to these intervals of quality, and hence mingle not only with each other, but each with all in a perfect unity, with few exceptions. Pagan philosophic systems discovered that man exists within the opalescent globe now termed the auric egg, or soul envelope. This auric egg, its lower sheaths at least, totally isolates man from the rest of the universe, admitting through its poles only sufficient of the universal agent to maintain him in his isolated embryonic individualism, for this auric egg is the womb in which the prenatal life of mortality is passed. As long as he remains an individual, man is an embryo. As long as he is in this embryonic state, he is immortal, and as long as he is immortal, he must exemplify the mortal principle of separateness. While he may fit together with the other parts so as to form a comb-like fabric, he can never actually mingle his own nature with that of any other creature. Men mix with each other as oil mixes with water, but the gods mingle as oils, for all have the same essential base. Divinity, exemplifying similars, forever mingles with itself. Humanity, exemplifying dissimilars, may be brought together, yet a certain separateness inevitably remains as long as humanus remains.